So we are good to go. Welcome, everybody. It's lovely to see familiar faces and unfamiliar faces. My name is Susan Medaglia, and our guest, obviously, is David Maloof. We have a full house, and the topic today is the music of writing, but we're probably going to veer off in all sorts of directions. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we meet today on the land of the Whadjuk Noongar people, the traditional owners and custodians of the land, and to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. So, to introduce our special guest, David Maloof, who, as they say, needs no introduction, but David is, of course, one of our most acclaimed and internationally acclaimed writer, not only of short stories, which is partly why he's here, but also of novellas, novels, poetry, essays, libretti, a play. Have I left anything out? I did suggest last night in our opening speech that he should try rap music next. I think that might work. So in a career spanning four decades, David's writing has received many awards and accolades, including the Neustadt International Prize for Literature, the International Impact Dublin Literary Award, the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, the French Prix Féminin Étranger, and the Australia Asia Award. And he has many titles, including a National Living Treasurer, I think. It's a great title.
It's very hard to cash in.
But most recently, in 2008, David was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and in 2016 received the Australia Council Award for Lifetime Achievement in Literature. And he is still happily writing. His most recent publication appeared just this month. It's a collection of poems in a very beautiful hardback edition called An Open Book. So please join me in welcoming David Maloof. So, because the topic is the music of writing, I wanted to begin by asking you to comment on something you wrote in the Sydney Review of Books in 2013, in which you considered the value of learning poems off by heart as a school child. So how did that kind of rote learning, listening to, how did that influence your writing?
Oh, look, I think deeply, really. I belong to a generation where something that today is considered child abuse, which is making kids learn poetry. I've actually heard that in a lot of schools it's used as a punishment now. You know, because you can't beat them, you can send them off to learn a poem like that. But we learned huge amounts of poetry by heart. I mean, I can, you know, John Gilpin and Milton's L'Allegro and Wordsworth's To Daffodils. What I would say about that, and what I think it taught me, was two things. One is that if you learn a poem off by heart, you very, very quickly learn not to be afraid of poetry, because you actually get possession of it. You know, you've got it. You've got it off by heart. And the second thing about that is that it convinced me utterly that about probably more than 50% of the meaning of a poem and the experience of the poem lies in music. And by the meaning, I mean that if you write poetry, you know very, very well, if you're using rhymes, that the rhyme leads you in writing the poetry as much as anything else. It is what provides where the poem is going to go next. And if you're writing even without rhyme, it's very often the sound in the poem that you're following and allowing to lead you as much as the meaning. So the sound and the meaning are absolutely locked together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think of a poem like Wordsworth's To Daffodils, which I would have learned, say, when I was 9 or 10, A 9 or a 10-year-old kid cannot grasp what that poem means. But if you have it by heart and you get to university and at 19 you're faced with the poem again and you have to start trying to work out what the poem is saying, it's astonishing how much of what you know about the poem you actually know through the fact of having it in your head as a sound, a body of sound that's a kind of piece of music. I think that's really, really important. And certainly in my writing, when I'm writing poetry, I'm following as much the sound as any kind of argument. Mm.
I think it was T.S. Eliot, well, I know it was T.S. Eliot, who has been famously called a poet with an auditory imagination, who said that a poem can be appreciated before it's understood.
Yeah,
it's that,
yeah.
that kind of idea,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a kind of intuitive understanding, perhaps, of the music, but not a rational one.
Yeah. Well, especially these days when not only students but teachers are so scared of poetry, it's great to not have that fear because you know you can get a poem in your head and there it is.
Mm.
Yep. You've got it.
You, of course, are a poet yourself, but I want to read you a quote from William Faulkner, which you may know. He has a wonderful observation about writing in different modes. That's, I think, relevant to your own practice. So Faulkner said, maybe every novelist wants to write poetry first, finds he can't, and then tries to write the short story, which is the most demanding form after poetry. And failing that, only then does he take up novel writing. So you began as a novelist, didn't you? And then you turned to poetry and then to short stories. Is that right?
No,
I
began with poetry and I published, I think, 3 books of poetry before I published a novel.
Sorry. Yep.
I'd been working on the novel for about 10 years. I would have started writing the novel about 1963 when I was teaching in England, and I wrote about 5-6 drafts of it all through the 60s until I came back to Australia at the end of the 60s, and then I went off on a sabbatical in 1972 and wrote the draft of what became Jono. And I couldn't write that novel because I'd read so much that I was, as a lot of writers are when they start, completely intimidated by the fact that there are all those great books and what did I have to say that could possibly add to them. And you really have to let all of that fall out of your head. And it took me a very, very long while. And the other thing that happened was that the book I was writing, the novel I was writing, I thought because it had to be a modern novel that it had to be very clever and very roundabout and very considered, you know, in that very self-conscious kind of way. And it took me a very, very long time to see that every time I tried to do that, it was terrible. And the reason why I was doing that was not only because I thought it had to be clever, but because I didn't really want to face up to the material. And one way of not facing up to material is to write cleverly and obliquely all around it. And it was only when I went back to some poems I'd written, which were absolutely straightforward, and a poem like The Year of the Foxes, for example, you know, that just is straightforward statement, that I could say to myself, what if I just started writing the novel like that and faced up to everything I have to face up to, because I'm not hiding behind clever prose or roundabout ways of doing things. It was only when I did that I managed to sit down over 3 or 4 months and write a first draft. And short stories came later because it took me longer to produce one that I thought was any good.
So just staying with that issue of cleverness for a while, your opposition to cleverness, is that, do you think that's about trying to impress the reader rather than writing what's meaningful for you?
Yeah, I think it's also having in your head everything that's ever been written and posterity. And, you know, you've got to let all of those things fall out of your head. You've really got to come with a blank mind to a blank page.
Mm.
And, I mean, somebody who says... I mean, writers say this over and over again in different ways, but somebody who says all of that best is D.H. Lawrence, who says that you do not do the writing. What does the writing is what he calls your daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N. And he said, what you've got to do is sit with your hand firmly over your mouth so you do not speak, and let the daemon speak. And every word you say will be crap and will get in the way of what the daemon is trying to do for you. Takes you a very, very long time to learn that lesson, and a lot of discipline, which is not interfering, not saying, you know, I'm cleverer than whatever else it is. Shut up. Just sit quiet and listen rather than try and talk.
Mm. So that transition from poetry to novels, how can you explain that? What is such a different genre?
I think the process is mysterious, and the fact that you can do it or turn out to be able to do it is also mysterious, and you can't guarantee that it's going to happen, and you can't guarantee that you can do it. The thing that surprises me most is that when you're writing a novel, I almost never write a novel chronologically. Whenever I've had an idea for a novel, or even a novel like Jonah, I knew what that was about, sort of, before I started, but you usually don't, I always write the bit of the novel that I can see for the moment without knowing where it's going to be in the novel. And that's usually a small scene or a piece of dialogue between two people. And before you know it, you've written a page or a page and a half from the novel, and what you've got there is the narrative voice. And that's the real key to the whole thing. And once you've got the narrative voice, and once you've got a single episode, small moment though it may be, you're actually inside the world of the book. So you know what the world of the book is like. And if it's a conversation between people, you have two characters, at least. So I would usually do that. And then I would write as many of those little bits and pieces as I can see, without saying to myself where do they come from in the book. And only then do I get some idea of what the book is about. And the beginning might be written almost at the end. Often I know what the end is, and I know what I'm working towards. So, you know, that's not everybody's way of working, but that's the way that I've always found I could work. So the novel then becomes kind of free, because it's not based on plot, and it's not based even necessarily on a chronology that I can see as yet. What's there, which is the essential thing, is the tone of voice. And once you've hit the tone of voice, essentially a novel will write itself. The thing that I don't understand is, if you're writing a novel, you have to do it every day. It's a bit like being an athlete. If you leave 3 days without writing, when you go back to the fourth day, it's very, very, very hard. And what's hard is to fall into that state where the writing starts to happen almost unconsciously, almost automatically. But the thing that is puzzling to me and just absolutely mysterious is, you sit there and you write maybe 500 words each day, and it'll be for 3 months or 6 months or a year or whatever it is, and somehow when you're just taking this little bit, going this little bit further, a little bit further. But when you actually get the book has this complete arc like that. And you think, where's that come from? Where has it come from? It's somehow, it must be in your mind right from the beginning, or it's in the writing right from the beginning, or it's because what you're dealing with is something organic, that once you start off on the arc, the whole arc kind of completes itself. I don't understand that. No, it's completely mysterious. And how you acquire a capacity to do that, I have absolutely no idea.
Okay, so that's for all you aspiring writers. You don't have to know what you're doing. You just succumb to the mystery.
Well, you've got to...